From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
So I'm looking at these trees, and they're hanging with these record crops, and I'm wondering, how in the heck are they doing this? How are they able to pull off a record crop when they ostensibly have no water?
That's journalist Mark Arax. We've been talking about the huge 54-page feature he recently wrote for the California Sunday Magazine. It's about a billionaire couple named Stuart and Linda Resnick. Perhaps you haven't heard of them, but you've probably seen, if not consumed, their products. Think Fiji Water, the wonderful brand of both pistachios and pomegranates, and Halo Oranges, which used to be called Cuties. Stuart and Linda Resnick happen to be the biggest farmers of irrigated land in the U.S. In a weird way, you could say they primarily farm water, but in the form of fruits and nuts. Naturally, there's a lot of public interest in the couple, but they've rarely spoken to the press. Until now, that is. So, who are they?
Well, let's start with Stuart Resnick. You know, he's a farmer, but he's the most improbable of farmers. He comes from New Jersey. His father was a bar owner, and he made his way west to go to law school at UCLA. He had a side business where he was cleaning buildings while he was a student. And by the time he graduated from law school, he was well on his way to being a millionaire. And the piece ends up looking at how he takes a small fortune and turns it into a larger fortune and a larger fortune. And then, you know, on to now $5 billion worth of fortune.
I mean, sort of famously, the Resnicks, like everything they touched seemed to turn to gold. They did the Franklin Mint, Teleflora, Fiji Water. And then they had this idea of ranching. And it seems that, as you describe it in the piece, his purchasing of Paramount Ranch was almost an afterthought, just a place to park some money.
Yeah, it was a hedge against inflation. He had divorced his first wife. He met Linda right around the time they bought the Franklin Mint. And then they leveraged that into some other investments. And then at some point, you know, he was sitting down with his accountant, he decided he wanted a hedge against inflation. And someone called him up and told him about some citrus land in the town of Delano, where Cesar Chavez's farm worker movement began. And so he went and made a trip and came back with some orchards and a packing juice plant, I think. And he was a citrus grower. And then during that same time, there were these huge chunks of land in up and over the mountain from L.A. in Kern County that the oil companies were getting rid of. In some cases, they had planted almond trees and things like that, pomegranate trees on it. And he started buying, you know, 20, 30,000 acre, you know, swaths of that part of the, and then became, at some point, the biggest farmer of pistachios, almonds, citrus, and pomegranates in the world.
How much land does he farm there?
Yeah, I asked him that several times. I mean, each time over the years I would ask the question, it would change. He wouldn't know. He'd have to go check. But as it turns out, I think it's 181,000 acres of California he owns, or 180, and 121,000 of those acres he is farming with those crops. He also has 21,000 acres split in between Texas and Mexico, where he's growing these wonderful grapefruits and limes.
So we're not talking about wonderful used as a descriptive adjective in this sense. You're also playing with the fact that it's the brand name of the company.
That's right. The name of the company, as if it wasn't big enough and grand enough, was Paramount. And Linda decided that didn't quite fit what they were trying to do, so she rebranded it as Wonderful. And, you know, she's a master brander, and so much of their success has been this kind of strange wedding between the culture of the valley, the big valley, the farming culture, the dirt culture, and then the culture of hype and marketing of Los Angeles. And they brought those two things together in a way that's created this pretty special company.
How much of the nation's nut market is theirs?
When I first met Stuart Resnick and we sat down to talk, which was about 8-10 years ago, he controlled 60%, if not 65%, of the pistachio market. He had a monopoly there, and he could pretty much dictate things. The planting of pistachios has really increased in the San Joaquin Valley, and so he controls about 40%. He still has a position that affords him the largest voice, an outsized voice in not just the growing, but the marketing, the processing of pistachios. Almonds less so, but still significant. He's the biggest almond grower in the world. And then pomegranates, even though the palm tanks have backed up with supply and there's a certain kind of glut and he's pulled out 8,000 to 10,000 acres, if not more, he still is the largest pomegranate grower and juicer in the world.
And then those really easily peeled mandarins called cuties.
That's right. He and a gentleman named Byrne Evans, a big citrus grower out of Southern California, they partnered up in these easy-to-peel mandarins. There are actually three varieties of them. And the ones that come late in the year aren't so sweet. The ones that come in spring are even better. But Linda decided that she would name them cuties. And this partnership lasted and did well by both of these men for several years. And then they got into an argument over a bunch of complicated things. It turned pretty ugly. And Byrne Evans ended up with the cutie brand. He had to pay Resnick a good chunk of change for that. And then Linda took those same mandarins, those same three types of mandarins, and then rebranded them Halos.
So let's talk about water, because this story is really a story about water. When we think about water and we think about the valley, often we're thinking about row crops, things that if you don't have a good allotment of water, you can choose not to put seeds in those years. But when you talk about trees, you're talking about something else. Your initial investment is much, much higher, and you can't just make decisions year to year on what you're going to keep alive and what you're going to let die.
That's right. We have and it's not just climate change. Climate change is obviously compounding it. But if you look back at the history of California, we swing between drought and flood. Sometimes long droughts, sometimes short floods. Usually a long drought will end in a flood. You know, the average is kind of a lie in California. So early on, the crops were cotton and vegetables and things of this nature that theoretically, if your water was short or you were in a drought cycle, you could then idle some land and you could respond. You had a margin to respond to the dry times. As we have seen an astonishing cultural shift, and I call it culture because it's agriculture, from those row crops to now permanent crops, orchards, vineyards, that ability to respond to drought has been lost. And then what's happened, and the Resnick Empire kingdom kind of shows this in an extreme, is the farmers then, even as they've lost that margin to respond to drought, then they've planted these orchards wall to wall, meaning from one edge of their land to the other edge. And so there's not even a margin built into the land. And so when drought comes, like this last one did, they get pretty desperate for water. And that is what this piece examines. I am out on the land in the middle of this drought. And this particular land that I'm looking at in Lost Hills, which is a company town, a Resnick company town, 140 miles, but the crow flies, from their house in Beverly Hills. This land has no groundwater. So it doesn't even have the margin of groundwater to save itself during drought. So I'm looking at these trees and they're hanging with these record crops. And I'm wondering, how in the heck are they doing this? How are they able to pull off a record crop when they ostensibly have no water? They don't have groundwater. They planted wall to wall and the state water project basically wasn't delivering anything for a couple years. So that becomes the mystery that I raise early in the piece and that kind of tugs the reader through as I discover this secret pipeline that is bringing water from 50, 60 miles away and shipping it into the nut orchards of Lost Hills.
So what's fascinating to me about that sort of hidden secret water pipe that's taking that water from a different county and from under the ground of different owners and bringing them to the Resnick land is that it's just an extreme sort of version of how they built the ability to irrigate all of these acres from the beginning. Could you talk about the Resnick's initial relationship with water and the water bank that they were able to acquire?
So the Resnicks farm 120,000 acres. Some of that land is in the Central Valley Federal Project, so it's federal water. Some of it's in the State Water Project. Some of it is in neither project, but it's on land that has groundwater. These particular acres, the most intensively farmed acres perhaps in the world, that area around Lost Hills where all these pistachios and almonds and pomegranates and citrus are grown. That area has no groundwater, as we said. So to try to develop some kind of hedge, some kind of margin, back in the 90s, Resnick and his people were able to acquire a water bank. Now, this water bank had been jump-started with $75 million in taxpayer money. The state was going to do it, but they kept running into resistance from Kern County, the locals, and the state kind of didn't want to do it. And so there were these series of secret meetings in Monterey, and as part of these negotiations about state water and where it was going, and if you could sell it or not, as part of those negotiations, the Resnicks were able to acquire this water bank. And that water bank, in flood years, you can park up to 1 million acre-feet of water in there. And so that becomes their groundwater. So Lost Hills is, you know, if you're going to gamble, that's where you gamble the biggest. But the water bank gave them a little bit of certainty. The problem was by year 3 and 4 of the drought, the water bank water had run out. So how did they get this water? And what I end up finding out is they end up buying some of this water, $200 million worth, from another king of agriculture, the J.G. Boswell Company, and some others. And then they also do this secret pipeline, which I discover one day in the shadow of the California Aqueduct as it's moving snowmelt from north to south. There's this silver pipeline. It looks like a snake kind of slithering there. And this was this pipeline that in this time of desperation was moving not a great amount of water, but a steady amount of water that had been pumped out of the ground by another billionaire and then sent to the Resnicks.
Who are the people who work in the orchards for Paramount / Wonderful? Could you describe where they live and the conditions and the community there?
Lost Hills, as I said, is basically a modern-day company town. I remember when I was back east going to see Hershey, Pennsylvania, and it's not unlike that in concept, but it's very different, you know, the way it looks. It's a place of extraction. There are oil wells pumping oil out of the ground of Kern County, and then the land is growing all these crops, and right through the middle of town runs the California Aqueduct. It couldn't be a more perfect metaphor for everything. And the people are poor, as is our habit here in the San Joaquin Valley for more than a century. We've gone out and imported our labor to do the dirtiest and some of the hardest labor known to man. And so we have reached deeper and deeper into the rural heart of Mexico and pulled out these workers. They live there. A lot of them have come without documents or with documents that are phony, and they have found work in those orchards. And so it was a really bleak place for a long time. At some point, about 7, 8 years ago, a light bulb went on inside the heads of Stuart and Linda Resnick, and they decided, well, this is our town. We're going to have to do something. And so there was a shift. All the money they were spending on cultural things and institutions in L.A., they shifted in this extraordinary way to try to prop up this place and make it better. And that's what makes this piece so complex. You know, you want to paint them as these kind of, I didn't want to paint them, but critics would want to paint them as these cardboard bad folks. But it's much more gray, much more complicated than that, and especially this philanthropy. There's no agricultural company in the West that's ever done this, probably in the nation, the level of giving. And it's not just Linda writing checks or Stuart writing checks. She's writing the checks, and then she's running these programs, school programs, health programs, trying to wean them off of tortillas and get them to eat food that's rich in all these things that are going to change the microbial contents in their guts. It's weird, quirky. The philanthropy almost borders on social engineering, and that's another kind of complexity that I confront as I'm working my way through this place.
They were in the news a couple years ago when the media was alerted of leveling of acres of California oaks to plant wine grapes and a ton of residential retirees and farmers, ranchers, whose wells were going dry. What is the general attitude towards them in the farming community and industry?
I think farmers are intimidated by them. Part of that has to do with the giving that they're doing. It's never been done here before, and they feel that that makes them look bad. There's some real respect. They see how they farm and what they've been able to do. I think the episode there up and over the mountain in Paso Robles was emblematic of some of the things they do, where you know they go in and they remake the land. And then when there were complaints, they both said that we didn't know this was happening. And that happened at their Justin Winery. And when they found out, they said, they decided they were going to donate that expansion to some public good. There is a whole variety of kinds of feelings about them here.
Stuart Resnick is in his 80s, and none of his three children are interested in taking over this fruit and nut legacy. What will happen to the wonderful brand?
Well, that's a big question, and it's a question that goes to what's going to happen to so much of the land here in the middle of California. We're seeing hedge funds. We're seeing these leveraged buyouts. We're seeing insurance companies and others invest in this land. And so more and more, as the land gets concentrated into fewer and fewer hands, we're losing that small farm kind of sense. And actually, we've always had this conflict between small and big here. But it's getting more and more concentrated. And the question is going to become, you know, what's going to happen? And who's going to buy that? And, you know, he told me, I don't want to see it gone in a leveraged buyout. I'd like to see what we have developed stay on. But then who can take it on? And that's a major question, because the fear is as this land gets further and further away from the people who live here and controlled by outside powers, at some point that romanticism, that attachment to the soil gets lost. And you're going to see this land, the water gets stripped from the land, and then the water sold up and over the mountain to make more suburbs grow where you're at, and to maybe turn this valley into another San Fernando Valley. So that is the question that kind of sits over this whole story and the book that I'm working on.
Such a powerful piece and so beautifully written. Before we close, I'd love to leave our listeners with an image of the San Joaquin land we're talking about. Would you please read the description from your essay?
Okay. There's a mountain range to my left and a mountain range to my right, and in between a plain flatter than Kansas where crop and sky meet. One of the most dramatic alterations of the Earth's surface in human history took place here. The hills that existed back in Yokut Indian days were flattened by a hunk of metal called the Fresno Scraper. Every river busting out of the Sierra was bent sideways, if not backward, by a bulwark of ditches, levees, canals, and dams. The farmer corralled the snowmelt and erased the valley, its desert and marsh. He leveled its hog wallows, denuded its salt brush, and killed the last of its mustang, antelope, and tule elk. He emptied the sky of tens of millions of geese and drained the 800 square miles of Tulare Lake dry. He did this first in the name of wheat, and then beef, milk, raisins, cotton, and nuts. Once he finished grabbing the flow of the five rivers that ran across the plain, he used his turbine pumps to seize the water beneath the ground. As he bled the aquifer dry, he called on the government to bring him an even mightier river from afar. Down the great aqueduct, by freight of politics and gravity, came the excess waters of the Sacramento River. The farmer move the rain. The more water he got, the more crops he planted, and the more crops he planted, the more water he needed to plant more crops. And on, 1 million acres of the valley floor, greater than the size of Rhode Island, are now covered in almond trees.
Mark Erickson's article for the California Sunday Magazine about the Resniks is called A Kingdom of Water. I can't stress this enough. If you read one article only about agriculture this month or this year, make it this one. It's riveting. Find a link to it on the Good Food website. Coming up, we're talking more about water, this time with an author who's encouraging us to eat less of it. You heard that right. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
What I'm saying is consider when you purchase your wine or you purchase your egg, how it's being raised and what is the water story behind it.
That's Florencia Ramirez, Oxnard native and author of a book called Eat Less Water. Some experts say that in 2030, half the people living on Earth will experience intense water scarcity. Florencia traveled over 16,000 miles interviewing farmers and food producers about this issue. She says the answer partly begins in the kitchen. I bet this is really surprising for a lot of people. You know, as so many of us experienced the drought before, the message that was drummed into us was take really short showers, you know, cram everything into your dishwasher and do one load. But you're saying something quite different. But I have to say that you're book begins with this incredibly beautiful story about your father when he was an infant and he had this brush with death after an intense bout of dehydration. Why begin your book with this?
I wouldn't be here if it, water is life, but in my own family, it was a story that my dad would tell me over and over again about how he nearly died when he was just a newborn. And that this doctor came for free and saw that he was dehydrated and it was drops of water that saved his life. And it was just on one day when I was at one of these Earth Day events talking about showers and water reduction where I came across this gentleman who tells me the story about, did you know that one drop of water holds in a gallon bucket represents all the fresh water we have on this planet? And so that was like this blend of that gentleman who was a stranger and my own story that I'd heard over and over again my dad tell me as a child and that I retold to my own children and realizing that's really where the passion for water came from.
So let's talk about that one drop of water and the metaphor that it brings forth.
So we live on a water planet and the Earth is 2/3 water and 97.5% of that is salt water. Of the 2.5% fresh water, 69.5% of that is frozen. Another 30.1% hides in deep aquifers. But the remaining 0.4%, that's the drop in a bucket. That is the drop that sustains all the life on this planet.
It's pretty amazing. Water conservation seems to come and go in fads, and you would think that we had learned our lesson this last time. But let's talk about in the kitchen. Are we talking primarily about water use in farming?
Yes and no, because there are certainly water conservation things that we can do directly in our kitchens as well. But the lion's share of water use is at the farm level. And that's what I learned early on. So, for example, when they talk about a pound of beef is 1,800 gallons of water, or a loaf of bread is 460 gallons of water, or a single egg is 23 gallons of water. What most of that is coming from is at the farm level. For example, with a cow, it's how much food does an average cow eat and how much water does it take to raise the pasture or the soy or the corn that it, you know, to feed the cow through its lifetime.
So when we go to search for food, when we're in the market and we're reaching for something, what is the choice that we can make between one item and another that will cause us to consume less water?
What I found, I talk about in the book, is better and best. So, you know, when you have the question of, okay, what do I do when I'm in the grocery store? What do I buy? Better would be organic because you know already that they can't spray.
And I just have to jump in here. They can spray, but different things.
Yes, but there's much more restrictions about what they can spray on their soil. And I'm glad you mentioned that too, because say if you're a biodynamic farmer, they're not going to spray anything because it's even going beyond an organic, you know, USDA model. So that's like the better and best. So better is organic because you know at least, and there's no hormones, no antibiotics, because those things also end up in water systems. But best would be what I highlight in the book.
So you feature a recipe for green egg asparagus and spinach quiche. Tell me about the water color code for foods like green eggs.
So green means it's rain. It's natural rain and moisture. Blue is water is coming from the ground. It's water coming from rivers and reservoirs. The groundwater is what we use a tremendous amount of here in California and again around the world. And that's water that we're using as a renewable resource, and it's not.
I want to go back to chocolate because I think this would surprise a lot of people mm-hmm. that chocolate actually has a worse footprint than beef. How is that possible?
So a pound of chocolate is 7,727 gallons of water, where a pound of beef is 1,851 gallons of water. So if you're going on water footprint alone, you would say, then that means I can't eat chocolate because it's using so much water. But the water that they're using to grow chocolate or cacao is all green water. It's all rain-fed. That's why we don't grow chocolate here in California, because that would be a huge water bill.
Also, we tend not to eat, well, most of us tend not to eat a pound at a time.
What I would like to say as a final note is many people will think that you can't do this because it costs too much. Like, you know, I don't have the money to buy organic foods or to go to the farmer's market. And so first, there's so many things that you can do before you even get there. So for example, if you were to walk into my home kitchen, you'll see that I have a chalkboard with a menu written for the entire week. And so that planning of what you're going to eat, even if you're going to go out to eat, you know, on a particular night, like tonight, I'm going out to eat and I have that up on my chalkboard. But by planning it, we don't waste as much food, because here in the United States, we waste about 50% of our food. All of that food has a water footprint. So that is a big thing that we could all do. The other thing is just eating out less. Or if you do eat out, consider going to some of these restaurants that are supporting local farmers as well, like farm to table, or even some of these fast food establishments that are also supporting some of these, you know, more organic agriculture or local food like Chipotle or Sharky's, those types of things that are here. And then also teaching our kids to be chefs, bringing them back into the kitchen, back into the fold of what it is to know how to make a meal from start to finish. So my kids, which range from the ages of 10 and 14, they will often choose a night that they want to cook and give me what they need, what ingredients they need. They find what recipe they need that they want to do, and they give me the ingredients. And it's theirs to cook that meal, and then I do the dishes for them.
What a good mom. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome. Thank you.
That's Florencia Ramirez. Her book is called Eat Less Water. Continuing our focus on water, we turn our attention to a lake on the other side of the world. We're going to Cambodia.
Well, it's funny because I've started reading some very old texts about Cambodia, and almost all of them, they mention the lake in some degree, and one of the things they're always commenting on, you know, whether it's a 13th century explorer from China or an emissary from France in the 1800s, is just this extraordinary abundance of fish. And they all seem taken by it. It's something that is not usual in many countries.
That's journalist Abby Seif. She recently wrote an article for Eater about Tonle Sap Lake in Cambodia, which is the lifeblood of the fishing economy. Local fishermen recall a time when fish could be caught simply by dipping a bucket into the lake. Not anymore. Last year, the Global Nature Fund declared the lake the most threatened body of water in the world. Abby joins me from Phnom Penh.
So the lake is the largest body of fresh water in all of Southeast Asia, and it really kind of bifurcates Cambodia. It cuts across the country in sort of a diagonal during the dry season, it's right in the middle. But then when the wet season happens, it does this sort of strange thing, and it expands hugely. So if you look at it, it kind of looks like the lake is covering the whole country.
I understand that it changes in size from around 1,000 square miles to 6,000 square miles.
It does. It has a pretty unusual phenomenon, which is that the river that feeds it, which is called the Tonle Sap River, is a tributary of the Mekong. And when the rains begin to fill the lake, the water actually pushes out the river and it changes course from the direction in which it normally flows. And that allows the lake to expand, you know, many times past its normal size.
Describe how the fish get there. Do the fish just arrive seasonally?
The fish get there in a lot of different ways. I mean, you're talking about a lake that has something like more than 100 species of fish. And some of the fish they kind of stay in the lake year round. But many of the fish, they're migratory fish. And so they really depend on that flood pulse to bring them to and from the Mekong. That's what allows the lake to be home to some of these huge, huge species of fish. Like I'm talking about, for instance, the giant Mekong catfish. It can be way more than 100 pounds. It's really a massive fish. And because it can move in and out of the Mekong, you get these pretty extraordinary species of fish.
So historically, it not only fed much of the Cambodian population, but there must have been a pretty big export market as well.
That's right. It's still a pretty big export market. They don't break out the figures in Cambodia, but fish, so from the lake, from the ocean, and from the rivers, it's something like a $2 billion export market. And much of that goes to neighboring Vietnam, and then some of it goes farther afield. But it's a fairly sizable market for the country.
In your article for Eater, you write, quote, as recently as a decade or two ago, fishers recount stocks were so plentiful they could dip a bowl in the water and come up with enough food for dinner, unquote. How much has that changed?
You know, most of this is coming from the fishermen themselves, but over the years I've spoken to scores of fishermen, and they're all giving pretty similar tales, and they're saying that 10, 15, 20 years ago, they were seeing kind of the same amount of fish that they've been seeing, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, since they were kids. And they say it's really only in the last 10 or 15 years that they've begun to see a decline, and they're not able to use it to support themselves in the way that they used to be.
Okay, is that a bird that you have in a cage in your house?
No, I'm sitting on my balcony, and there's quite an abundance of birds here in Phnom Penh to wake you up at ungodly hours.
What are the principal factors changing the ecology of the lake?
So there's a few. One is climate change, and one is kind of an increase in illegal fishing and simply greater population demands. But the biggest factor that's going to impact the lake over time is dams. The Mekong Basin is a pretty closely linked ecosystem, and there's just dozens of dams being built on the Mekong and on its tributaries, and that's going to see a huge decline in fish stocks.
Wow, everything is so complicated. Is the situation being addressed by the government?
No, part of the problem is governments in this region tend to just be very gung-ho on dams at the moment. They see it as a key to their electricity shortfalls, and it almost doesn't matter how rigorous the evidence is against dams. They really want to go forward with it.
That's journalist Abby Seif joining me from Cambodia. Find a link to her Eater article on the devastation of Tonle Sap Lake on the Good Food website. In a moment, we're looking at water from a different angle, through a whiskey glass to be precise. Stay with us for a deep dive into moonshine. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. This week, we've been looking at water and food. Now for something different. You might think of moonshine as something illegally produced in the backwoods of the South, but lately it's been popping up on the shelves of licensed liquor stores. Contributor Peter Gilstrap recently visited Tennessee for Good Food to learn about the real thing.
I'm standing in the dark in a laundry room in the South, Tennessee to be exact. It's a sultry night in July of 2006, and I've just moved to Nashville from Los Angeles. The only guy in town I know has brought me to a small party in a big house where everyone is reclining in the living room. They're sipping cocktails and waving their cigarettes around. They laugh lightly and blow smoke at the ceiling. It's all what you might call genteel. I never called anything in LA genteel. I'm a West Coast fish out of water here, but everybody's charming and gracious, and when someone calls me a Yankee, we all laugh. Lightly. They fill me in on humidity and honky-tonks and the best hot chicken in town, and then someone mentions moonshine. This is how I end up in the laundry room. I tell them I've never had moonshine. I didn't know it was still a thing. The party chatter stops and looks are exchanged. I mean, prohibition is long over with. You can buy liquor in stores now, right? Who would even make moonshine? But let's get back to the laundry room. The hostess has led me here, dangling the tempting sacrament of bona fide white lightning. She's calling me honey, and I'm calling her ma'am. She plants me next to her ancient Maytag, reaches into a high cupboard, and carefully takes down a mason jar filled with clear liquid. She pours a finger of it into a glass, hands it to me, and says, "Take a sip and don't move. Let it set for a minute. Let it grow." I do, and it does. It's warm and tastes like peaches mixed with a distant cousin of kerosene, but in a good way. Through the half-open window, the cicadas sing in the moonlight as this taboo liquor sears a path down to my gut and rockets back up into my skull. I'd experienced a number of alcohol-related sensations in Los Angeles. This is not one of them. "Now," she says, "how was that, honey?" Like a good Yankee, I hold out the empty glass in the darkness and ask for more. A few months later, I moved back to L.A. and figured my shine-sipping days were over. But recently, I began to notice something strange in Southern California. Moonshine, or something called moonshine, was popping up on liquor store shelves and in trendy bars. The stuff was in jars, not bottles. Jars with labels in old-timey fonts offering thrills in flavors like butterscotch gold, black smoke, and Dixie, whatever the hell Dixie is supposed to taste like. It just seemed wrong. Where was the proud backwoods tradition in all of this? And what about the crucial ingredient of lawbreaking that made drinking this stuff so special? Most of all, how can you call it moonshine when it's legal? I went back to Tennessee to find out.
Me and Mona, we've been knowing each other our whole lifetime. We were these bitty boys. We went to church every Sunday, didn't we? Every time the door was open.
Church of God.
Got up here.
You guys still go?
No.
We need to go.
This is Ricky Estes and Ronald Lawson. They're moonshiners. We're sitting in the woods of a place called Short Mountain, slapping mosquitoes about 60 miles southeast of Nashville. The mountain is on the outskirts of Woodbury, a town so small it's pretty much nothing but outskirts. Ricky and Ron grew up here and never left. Why would they? Their home distilling tradition is deeply ingrained in these parts, reaching back to their grandfathers.
My granddaddy and my uncles and all my whole family were moonshiners all my whole lifetime.
How'd you get into moonshining?
Me and another boy got laid off from a job we had at the same time. When we was riding around drinking beer one day, he said, "We need to get an outfit and start making some shine." I said, "Well, let's do it." About a week and a half later, we was in the woods setting it up.
He was 16 then. That was 49 years ago. Making this stuff is a dicey venture. Over the years, Ricky and Ron have dealt with government agents, local cops, and rival shiners trying to spike their cook with oil or salt, the kryptonite to a batch of good moonshine. Beyond the human threat, you've got pigs, rabbits, and rats that are all drawn by the tasty delights of fermenting sugar and corn mash. They climb in the barrels, but they can't climb out. The life of a moonshiner is not an easy one.
It's like anything else. If you ain't got a little pride about yourself and what you're doing, it ain't no count. And that was the way the moonshine was, wasn't it,
yep.
Ricky?
Yes, sir.
If you had pride about yourself and had pride about what you'd done and wanted it done the right way, you'd always have a place to go sell it.
If it wasn't for the U.S. government, nobody would have had to sell anything. When the 18th Amendment outlawed liquor in 1920, that didn't stop America's desperate, forbidden thirst.
It's against the law to drink, so drinking is suddenly smart. There's bootleg liquor on every American lip, shiny flask on every hip. By the middle 1920s, nightlife is having its heyday, for America's dry and high.
Illegal stills popped up in forests, swamps, basements, and bathtubs nationwide to satisfy that need. But Tennessee was way ahead of the game. By 1907, most of the state had already banned booze, so moonshiners had the craft down by the time Prohibition kicked in. They began supplying bootleggers who distributed their stuff around the country, thanks to organized crime syndicates. But transporting that hooch started with the men who made it.
And I hauled moonshine when I didn't have a driving license.
How old were you when you started driving?
Well, I had my own car when I was 11 years old.
11?
I bought it with moonshine.
It all boiled down to being able to outdrive the authorities. Before Ricky was 16, in a car carrying his father, his brothers, and a trunk filled with illegal still apparatus, he led the cops on a high-speed backwoods juggernaut.
Who won that chase?
We won it. Funny part about it, I had a pad of dash on my old 56 Ford, and they gripped their fingers so tight in that pad of dash that when I sold that car, you could still see their fingerprint.
That kind of driving gave America more than just liquor. That's right, NASCAR. We can thank shiners and bootleggers for the National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing. It was founded in 1948, born from the need to move black market booze and move it fast. These guys souped up their Detroit-made machines, honed their skills on winding country dirt roads, and when they weren't getting the adrenaline rush delivering booze, these bored motorheads raced each other. It was all so wrong, it just felt right.
Moonshine was always that illicit drink that you knew someone who knew someone who knew someone who made it.
That's Jim Myers. He's been writing about food and drink in Nashville for almost 20 years. He likes good moonshine, and he usually knows someone who knows someone.
It was always very secretive about who made it or how you got it. You didn't talk about it because people would be put in prison for making it.
Prohibition was repealed in 1933, but even today, people continue to cook illegally, minus permits, and they continue to get busted. In 2009, distilling permit laws were relaxed. Where the 800-pound gorillas in the Tennessee liquor jungle had long been George Dickel and Jack Daniels, small independent distilleries began opening up, and shine went legit. So did Ricky and Ronald, thanks to a former Angelino named Billy Kaufman. He arrived at Short Mountain 17 years ago in search of a life as an organic farmer.
I'm a community man, so I'm all about my neighbors and preserving the culture here without changing the culture here. I'm only doing what everyone around here is doing, which is farming and moonshining and celebrating that.
Actually, there are a couple other celebrations going on. Short Mountain is a small community that offers disparate attractions ranging from the Short Mountain Bible Camp to the Short Mountain Sanctuary, the largest, oldest LGBTQ commune in the nation. And of course, there's Kaufman's Short Mountain Distillery out on a lush 400-acre spread. It's a small batch operation specializing in locally produced organic Tennessee whiskey and moonshine, and it is where it is for a very specific reason.
So, Billy, what is this here? Where are we?
We're at a cave spring that is on the property. It's one of three cave springs, and this was the spring that was used by Cooper Melton, who was a moonshiner that actually made moonshine for Al Capone.
And this stream, this water, is where is it going? What's it used for?
Well, we use this water to make all of our products. So this water is as pure as it gets and is the reason there are so many moonshiners around Short Mountain. It's the reason why even before Prohibition, there were 18 legal stills around Short Mountain.
Kaufman wanted the real thing,
So we hired on Ricky and Ron to brew up the same 105-proof liquor they've been making for decades, hidden away in the hollers of the mountain.
So I came up here, and we set out yonder where that two shed is now. And he said, what do you think about making legal moonshine? I said, I think you've lost your damn mind. You can't make legal moonshine.
But you could, and you can, and they do.
Everything we make, everything that we bottle, we distill here. We never blend, we never flavor neutral grain spirits or anything like that. I even get people trying to get me to buy organic, already distilled spirits that I can then barrel or flavor. I won't do that. If I'm not going to make any money, I might as well be able to sleep at night thinking, you know, I'm actually a reputable person.
So that stuff I saw in mason jars on the shelves back in L.A., what is that stuff?
Now, when you go into a liquor store and go into the moonshine section, I guarantee you 90% of the things in there have recipes that were never made illegally.
For purists like Billy Kaufman and Jim Myers, this bastardized swill has dragged the good name of illegal moonshine through the mud.
So you saw this proliferation of all of these flavored moonshines in addition to regular moonshine. And the packaging has Jethro scrawled on the label, and it's in a mason jar kind of thing. And I didn't like it because it played off of the worst stereotypes of the South. Not an appreciation for what good moonshine was and how hard it was to make in a still in the woods where your source of water was a stream and you're using fire. So it's hard to control the process. And being able to ferment and distill something that was smooth and drinkable, that's an art.
Ricky and Ronald cooked their art, the distillery's Shiner's Select brand, on a larger replica of their old 50-gallon still. The original is still here in the woods, though, made out of fire-charred bricks and copper pipes and wooden barrels, all slowly being engulfed by trees and vines, consumed by the wall of green. Everything is green out here.
Me and Ron have also made some of the good moonshine you could make on that thing.
That thing blew up in 1992 and sent Ricky to the burn ward up in Nashville for 17 days. But he hasn't lost his affection for the booze machine he built.
It was a good running steel, wasn't it, Ron?
Yeah, it done a good job.
But back to the question that brought me here in the first place. What is moonshine these days? Evidently, it all comes down to semantics.
Well, yeah. You still using the same recipe. You're still making it just like you always made it. So it's still legal moonshine.
Or is it?
Moonshine is a word that means illegally made spirit. It's a fanciful word that means illegally made spirit. And legal moonshine is actually an oxymoron in a way, because you can't have legal moonshine.
So before our brains implode trying to grasp this hazy definition, let's just say that moonshine is a malleable concept. But the drink itself, at least in this corner of the South, is a high-proof time machine that has not changed, and Ricky and Ron are part of that. The only thing that's different for them is the side of the law they're on.
We had to sign a paper with ABC saying we'd quit and be good boys, so we don't make on our own. But, it's just something that gets in your blood and you enjoy doing.
Yep.
And you don't want to quit, you know.
I mean, I don't regret none of it. I'm glad I did it. And I'm glad we got it legalized where, we really can talk about it. And because it was a dying art, really, moonshine was.
And so moonshine lives on. Why not? It's an American tradition, part of our rich liquid heritage, a cocktail that was artisanal long before cocktails were artisanal. And now, you don't have to stand in the dark in a southern laundry room to drink it. For Good Food, I'm Peter Gilstrap.
Our thanks to Peter Gilstrap. This piece was made possible by the Independent Producer Project. Finally, an update on the health of LA's water supply and some practical tips to save water. That's after this short break. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. California may have ended its official drought emergency less than a year ago, but conserving water in our dry region is just as urgent as ever. Mark Gold is the UCLA Associate Vice Chancellor for Environment and Sustainability. He's been working in the field of water policy for decades. And yes, he's also brother to our favorite food critic, Jonathan Gold. Mark's here to share some ways Angelenos can practice conservative water use and help stave off another statewide drought. Hi, Mark. It's so great to have you.
Glad to be here.
So what is the current status of our water supply? It's been a really light rain year.
Yeah, we have this interesting dynamic where last year was such a wet year that from the standpoint of the status of our water supply for people, our reservoirs are doing okay. But from the standpoint of precipitation for outdoor landscaping and for our biodiversity, you know, we live in this incredible biodiversity hotspot here in the Los Angeles region. It's been absolutely miserable. We've had less than 3 inches of rain in the last 12 months.
So how is this going to affect us once the blazing heat comes back?
Well, we got a pretty large taste of that during the winter. We didn't even have to wait for that. I mean, we had record December temperatures and, you know, Santa Ana's that lasted for weeks. And the end result was, you know, the worst fire season in history within our region. And that was potentially a taste of things to come in the future where, you know, we had this amazing 5-year period of mega drought followed by an extremely wet year, which led all sorts of undergrowth and invasive weeds and plants to grow. And then that built up the fuel so that then we had another incredibly dry period that we're in the middle of. And that was all the fuel that was necessary to really get the fires going. And we saw the devastating consequences. So it's been a pretty scary few years because we've really seen the vulnerability of not only our water system with the near collapse of and scary nature of what happened up in the Oroville Dam, but also what happens within our landscapes and the vulnerability we see there for wildfire.
When rain does come to LA, the water that comes famously moves out to the ocean really quickly. I mean, that's how the system has been engineered historically. Are we trying to change our infrastructure so that we can keep more of it here when it does come?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's something that the region has been wrestling with for a very long time. We have this situation where if you look at the San Gabriel River and the San Gabriel Valley, actually that system is such that the runoff that goes into the San Gabriel River, LA County Flood Control District does a very, very good job of capturing that runoff and infiltrating it into the ground where it augments our local water supplies. But we look at the LA River, we look at Biona Creek, we look at Dominguez Channel, and we do an absolutely miserable job of capturing the runoff in those areas. And so there's definitely a big push here, even to the extent that the LA County Board of Supervisors is putting on the ballot in November a measure that's going to do a combination of, if it passes, of cleaning up our polluted stormwater, which causes our beaches to be polluted and look like landfills after every rain, but also to augment our local water supplies by doing a much better job of capturing that runoff rather than having it go to the ocean where we get no value from it.
What are some of the biggest water sucks that we unknowingly participate in?
You know, most people in this day and age have already changed out their toilets and put in low-flow shower heads in their bathrooms. And so that's great because those were really the big things that most people did in the 90s and the early 2000s. So what are the next things? Well, the next time you get an appliance for a washing machine, please, please, please get a water conservation washing machine. There are lots of low water use washing machines out there and they use a lot of water. The other thing, obviously, and this is really the big frontier in all of Southern California, is our outdoor landscaping. And we still have way too many lawns in the region. A lot of people are growing English gardens. And the reality is we have an incredible landscape here in our own backyard. Like I said, one of the most biodiverse places on the planet. So putting climate-appropriate native plants in your front and backyard and being judicious with your watering and putting in everything from drip irrigation to tying it to evapotranspiration meters so that you're watering the appropriate amount each time. Those are huge changes that have to be made in really changing our outdoor landscape ethic. And that's where we're really going to make the most bang for the buck in reducing water consumption in the region.
When we always hear, you know, take shorter showers, how essential is that?
I mean, it's one of those situations where every little bit helps, but it's not nearly as big as take out your lawn and put in climate-appropriate native plants. And that's a much bigger thing. And so I'm one of those people who's a little obsessive about this and have been forever. You know, I capture the water in my shower before it heats up and then just use that for irrigation around our backyard and front yard.
Also, the thing about saving that initial cold pulse of water from the shower is that maybe you don't have to go to the gym as often.
Yeah, there you go. It's one of those things that you just sort of get used to. You know, you get one of those Home Depot giant orange buckets, and it's sort of a fixture in our bathroom and has been for over a decade.
What about those of us who cook a lot at home and restaurant cooks? Any advice?
Well, the people who run the restaurants, you know, luckily now you have to ask for water before you get it most of the time. And hopefully that's a permanent fixture in how we deal with these sorts of things. Having incredibly water efficient dishwashing equipment is hugely important. And again, washing machines for the linens and making sure that that's low water use. And there's really great stuff on the market right now that doesn't really cost any more than the normal sorts of appliances. And so it's pretty easy to be water efficient in this day and age.
Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciate the time you take visiting us.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
That's Mark Gold, the Associate Vice Chancellor for Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. We've been chatting about ways to cut down on water use. That's it for our water show. A quick note, on Tuesday, March 13th, the music and food podcast called Snacky Tunes will stage a live show at the El Rey Theater. The evening features a performance by singer-songwriter Naya and interviews with Michael Wexler and Michael Kassar of Wexler's Deli. Tickets are $30 and include food from Wexler's. Get tickets and info at theelrey.com. If you missed any part of this week's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Find us on Apple Podcasts, and please leave us a review if you like the show. Thanks to the Good Food team, I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.